Well, Josh Krasauer is back with us this afternoon. He's one of my favorite pundits. He's been with me for a long time on this show, 97.1 FM Talk Political Insider. He's the editor-in-chief of the Jewish Insider, and you see him on Fox News all the time and on Fox Radio. You hear him. Josh, how are you? I hope you're having a good summer.
It's great. Great to be back with you, Mark. It's summer here in D.C., but there's never a dull moment when it comes to news out of the White House.
And Missouri supplied some of that news this week, sending our attorney general, or I guess our former attorney general, Andrew Bailey, to the FBI. We've got, man, if you're attorney general in Missouri, you last about 2 years and then you go on to better things. That seems to be the pattern right now.
Yeah, no, that's a big story in Missouri for the rapid ascent of Andrew Bailey. There's also, the layering of Dan Bongino in the deputy AG role. That seems like his role may be diminishing somewhat.
Yes,
in Washington.
Yes, it
especially
does.
Especially amid the Jeffrey Epstein news.
Yeah, so what are your thoughts on that? Because it seemed like that was an unusual, well, I was surprised by it. I didn't think that was going to happen, that Andrew Bailey was going to go to Washington. So what's your take on what happened here? Is it because, you're saying it's because of some of the Epstein stuff related to Bongino?
Well, yeah, look, I don't have any new reporting, but it's well established that, look, Dan Bongino was an unconventional pick for that deputy FBI director's position. He's a podcaster. He's a provocateur. And when you're in government, you have to play team ball. And it was with the questions over release of Epstein, information from the government, being on the same team and being in the same, holding the line with Pam Bondi and with the White House became challenging, at least some parts of his listening audience in the past. And the base of the MAGA movement was very frustrated with Bongino, and we're giving him some hell online, and it became very frustrating. So, look, I'm not sure if he's going to be lasting long in that position. I think the hiring of Bailey is a sign that Bongino may not be in that role too much longer. But it is, at the very least, a very unconventional setup where you have essentially two deputy AGs reporting to Kash Patel at the FBI.
Do you think, a couple of weeks ago I heard, is Pam Bondi's job on the line just a little bit for some of those same reasons? Is she on the hot seat or not?
No, I never thought. I said so as much at the time. Look, Donald Trump, President Trump, trusts Pam Bondi. There's a loyalty there, and look, I think we are now past that political storm where, a couple weeks after all the heat the White House was facing, Donald Trump still has record high support within the Republican Party. I think Pam Bondi, if you look at the polls, her own image is taking a hit, especially among maybe some independents and maybe some of the MAGA base. But ultimately, Trump is the decider. He does trust Pam Bondi. She's been one of his loyal soldiers when it comes to enforcing some of the executive orders he's made with policing in D.C., National Guard showing up in the nation's capital. She's been a face of that decision. And I think there's no sign at all that she is in trouble at the Justice Department.
So what do you think right now of the D.C., I don't know if you want to call it a takeover, whatever it's referred to as? You're essentially a D.C. resident. I always used to see out there, it's been a few years since I've been to D.C., and I used to stay right there by Union Station. Obviously, there is, the contention that this is, again, that something that Trump is doing because of politics and Epstein. I think that's a bunch of crap. You probably saw earlier today Pete Hegseth and the vice president, making some comments about this situation. Then you have questions about the crime rates maybe being manipulated. It seems like a lot of people, even Joe Scarborough, Josh, who finally have to be honest about the situation, admit, yeah, this is a little bit of a problem, and folks probably want something done about it in the nation's capital.
Yeah, look, crime has been a problem in the nation's capital. It was worse a few years ago. The trend has been in the right direction, by the way, because of Republicans in Congress. When Biden was president, the D.C. City Council wanted to actually loosen penalties for some serious crimes at a time when D.C. was facing, at the time, record levels of crime. And it became so politically toxic that even Joe Biden and President Biden supported overruling the D.C. Council. And what ended up happening in D.C. is that the moderates on the city council, the mayor, who tends to be more moderate on these issues, actually won the fight, and more punitive penalties, more stronger penalties were actually enforced when it came to felonies and carjackings and other serious crimes. One bit, the problem, I think, with the – I think the public looks at Washington and they don't – Many of them don't see this as excessive. They think that D.C. needs more law enforcement, and they don't view the National Guard hanging out being a problem. Look, the challenge is I think a lot of the National Guard is stationed at the National Mall, the Lincoln Memorial. These are not the high crime areas in D.C., like the Columbia Heights, Anacostia. You know, there are other parts of the city that probably could use more law enforcement, and I'm not sure if they're getting that level of support. And secondarily, look, the biggest issue, and then Jeanine Pirro, the new U.S. attorney in D.C., has really been ahead of the curve on this. But one of the biggest problems when it comes to D.C. crime is that juveniles, anyone under, not just juveniles, anyone under the age of 25, judges can basically let them loose. They have a great deal of discretion in terms of how much time they serve, even if it's for a murder or a violent crime. And that's an issue that you see these repeat offenders that are juveniles out on the streets reoffending. You see, there was a guy someone was shot at a metro at a bus station. It was the suspect was 19 years old. They got a very light sentence. There are many instances like this, and partly is because of the D.C. law that basically gives judges incredible amounts of discretion in loosening the penalties for some of these serious crimes.
You know, we have this weird situation here, and I just learned about we have a point system for these juvenile offenders. This kind of came up a couple of weeks ago. We had these group of 14-year-old kids who carjacked an Uber driver, and they were arrested. There was a weapon involved, and they're pulled into custody. They're released to their parents. 2 days later, they do the same thing to a Lyft driver. So, you know, the criminals are educated. The older people know that the young kids aren't going to get in trouble. You get these points based on felonies. How, in fact, you can't reach the maximum 15 points when you carjack someone and use a gun, I think, is now up for debate here in Missouri and in St. Louis. But it's, you know, some of these things, the pattern is the same from my city all the way to your city. Josh Krossauer is with us this afternoon. All right, is Trump going to score another victory here when it comes to Putin and Zelensky, or are we being a little bit too optimistic right now?
I am more pessimistic. I think there's a lot. Trump likes the drama, the glamour that we saw this week in Washington with really every major European world leader coming to Washington, having conversations, including Zelensky, the Ukrainian leader, having conversations about a possible negotiation. But we're not hearing much from Russia, and we're not hearing much pressure. I mean, the problem is that by giving Putin essentially the red carpet out in Alaska and giving him sort of and backing down from the potential sanctions and from the discussion of a ceasefire, which was the whole point of a lot of these negotiations in the first place, we really haven't kept the pressure up on Putin. So it doesn't look like Putin's in any mood to meet with to have any of these trilateral negotiations. He's stalling as he has throughout this whole process. He's continuing to attack Ukraine. A lot of civilians being killed on a daily basis. So look, Lindsey Graham and Richard Blumenthal in the Senate have a tough sanctions bill that they've been promoting and really eager to get going. And I think if Russia isn't serious about cutting the deal, I think, at a certain point, Trump has to lay the punishment on. And we haven't seen a whole lot of that despite some encouraging moves and some high profile diplomacy. Ultimately, there hasn't been a lot of movement towards actually getting Russia to stop killing Ukrainians and to stop attacking Ukraine and to actually come up with some agreement.
Let's move to Texas and the redistricting. We're going to try to do some of this here. I'm a little uncomfortable with it just because I understand the point. I know that Trump's putting pressure on our governor, Mike Kehoe, and the legislature is going to be likely called into a special session or what they call an extraordinary session. They're going to try to redraw the maps here. I'm uncomfortable from this standpoint that I don't think voters really like it when you start doing these things every couple years. Then again, I don't know how dialed in people will really be, but obviously, there's a little competition going right now, whether it's Texas or California or Missouri, to make sure the numbers are there for Republicans next fall, Josh.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of partisan machinations from California to Texas and into Missouri and Indiana. And look, first of all, I think getting a few extra seats probably isn't going to make the difference between Republicans. If it's not, usually the party in power loses seats, and sometimes they can lose a lot of seats
typically
in a bad year.
Right.
Republicans hold a very narrow majority. So let's say they get 4 or 5 seats out of Texas, and let's say California doesn't do anything. I still don't know that if that's going to make the difference between, if it's not a good night for Republicans, you're not going to be able to gerrymander your way into the House majority or holding the House majority. So I also think there's some risks involved. You really look at the Texas map. Look, I think they'll get at least several seats out of that redraw. But a lot of the map is premised on the fact that Hispanic voters, which swung very much to Trump and to the Republicans in 2024. A lot of that is premised on the fact that they're going to stay with the Republicans. There are a couple majority Hispanic districts that actually went for Biden or were actually a little more Democratic not that long ago. And I think when it comes to immigration policy, look, these folks are very anti-illegal immigration, tough on border security. But when you see images of laborers, of people who are here illegally but are not committing any crimes, that are being, you know, pulled over, deported, that's not playing well with the Hispanic community across the country. Poland is starting to show that. And I think there could be a little bit of, sometimes you get two, your eyes are bigger than your stomach, and you're like, oh, I can win this seat and this seat and this seat. Well, two of those seats, those Hispanic majority seats, might actually not be as winnable for Republicans as they think. And they may end up, you know, costing their party in the long term if they get a little too greedy.
Yeah, and I get that. So, and all these races are local. So, and you have to have, you know, you and I have talked about this, the quality of the candidate really does matter in these local congressional races. But then you have the other side of the equation right now. And maybe this is more bigger picture toward, and I can't even believe I'm talking about, you know, 28 at this point. But, you know, Mamdani is the gift that keeps on giving for Republicans, sort of like Cori Bush was here in St. Louis. So a lot can happen between now, certainly, and next year, and certainly now and in a few years. But it seems like you have the Democrats, outside of maybe a guy like Rahm Emanuel, who's trying to talk common sense, still way out there on the fringes of most of these issues. So that's got to help Republicans.
Yep. Oh, yeah. I mean, look, big picture for the midterms, I think Republicans are still very, very heavily favored to hold the Senate, probably with a pretty decent majority like they have now. And the House, look, I think we saw 2018, where Democrats gained about 40 seats. You're not going to see that for a whole host of reasons. But a big part of that is that the Democratic Party has gone so far to the left, and also if you look at some of the data from the New York Times reporting today, the registration numbers for the Democratic Party
are
historic
way down, right?
Lows.
Yeah,
mean, people are leaving. The moderates are leaving the Democratic Party. They're becoming independents. Some of them are even becoming Republicans. And that means that the party is becoming more left-wing, more radical, and less appealing to the broader public. So the Democrats have a whole host of problems. If Mamdani gets elected in New York City, these New York swing seats are going to be hard for Democrats to win over because of the unique local issue that presents the Democratic Party. So, look, I would say Democrats probably are favored to win the House, but will they get the kind of wave? Will they get the kind of big result that they've experienced in other recent elections? Unlikely. I think it's more, we're talking more like 10, 15 seats than the bigger numbers that we've seen in recent elections.
Well, let's at least close here as we often do with baseball. You know, 6-7 weeks ago, we had some hopes that the Cardinals were going to be able to compete in this division and in the wild card. I know that technically we're still alive. I think the fan base has kind of moved on to whatever might happen next season and beyond. But I got to tell you something, Josh, I don't know if you follow this at all, but you know, our crowds here in St. Louis look like, you know, Cincinnati or maybe D.C. and, you know, maybe not as bad as Pittsburgh, but they're not looking good. You know, we usually draw 3 million. We're not going to get even close to that right now. And the fans are frustrated because we're not quite as far back as the Nationals are in your division. But, you know, the expectations here in St. Louis to compete year after year after year, that's kind of gone by the wayside. And the fans are speaking with their wallets right now, not filling the seats at Busch Stadium.
Yeah, I mean, we're experiencing the same thing. And well, I mean, it's been a tough run for both of our franchises. Look, for DC, it's ownership, and a lot of it starts at the top. And I think, I mean, the Cardinals do have, you know, the farm system, I think, has not been quite as bountiful for the Cardinals. We used to have like a real supply of good young talent, and that's kind of dried up.
And yeah, we traded them all away. All the young talent we had, we traded, like Randy Rosarena and others.
it's kind of remarkable. And the Cardinals are so good for so long, it's hard to imagine the Cardinals not making the playoffs. But look, I think it starts at the top. You got to have a general manager that can sign good players and bring talent into the organization. And it's been a little bit of a dry spell.
Yeah.
And just like in the National, we know this in Washington. It's been that way since 2020.
We got a little transition there because John Mozeliak is in his last year, and this Chaim Bloom guy is coming in to run the show. Josh Krossauer, always great to have you on. I hope your summer's going well. We'll talk again soon. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Mark.